From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. Today's show is the second in a two-part series on the healthcare safety net in the United States. The safety net includes programs that take a frontline role in responding to the healthcare needs of poor communities, and especially the needs of the 44 million individuals in the United States who don't have health insurance coverage. Last month, we looked at free clinics, using the free clinics in the state of Vermont as a case study. On today's show, our guests, Fitzhugh Mullen and Gordon Schiff, are joining us to extend our look at the safety net to the community health centers, the migrant health centers, the National Health Service Corps, and the public hospitals. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's show is the second in a two-part series on the healthcare safety net in the United States. Unlike all the other developed nations, the United States has allowed a large portion of its population, about 44 million people according to the U.S. Census, to go without health insurance. The high prices of medical care make it difficult for these individuals to seek care at most doctor's offices and hospitals. Many doctors across the country allow uninsured patients into their offices and are willing to waive or reduce fees. But a number of institutions, all with varying degrees of public funding, are specifically designed to address the health care needs of the poor and uninsured. Taken together, these institutions are referred to as the healthcare safety net. On last month's show, we took an in-depth look at the free clinics in the state of Vermont. In Vermont, free clinics have assumed an especially prominent role in the safety net compared to most of the other states. We spoke to many staff members and free clinic patients and were able to see the successes and limitations of the free clinics. That show is accessible at our website, publichealthradio.org. Today, we're going to look at four other important programs that provide care to the poor and uninsured. These are the Community and Migrant Health Centers, the National Health Service Corps, and the public hospitals. Between 1940 and the 1960s, the strong union movement gradually made family health insurance coverage a relatively common employment-related benefit at unionized workplaces. Unfortunately, this still left the vast majority of Americans uninsured at a time when health care was improving in effectiveness and becoming increasingly expensive. Two major pieces of health care legislation were enacted in 1965 to address this problem: Medicare, which provided care for all senior citizens, and Medicaid, which ensures extremely impoverished individuals. But despite these landmark pieces of legislation, most poor communities still had large numbers of uninsured individuals, and few doctors were choosing to work in poor urban and isolated rural communities. Later in today's show, we'll learn about the role of public hospitals in responding to these problems. And we'll also learn about the National Health Service Corps, a federal program that provides financial support for doctors and other health professionals to work in poor and medically underserved communities. The first health centers were funded by the federal government in the 1960s, and in 1969, the Public Health Service assumed responsibility for the health center program. Currently, community and migrant health centers are operating at 3,000 sites across the country. To receive federal support for a community health center, there must generally be poor public health indicators in the community. There must be a high rate of poverty and an inadequate number of doctors and other health professionals. All health centers provide reduced fees for uninsured individuals with a sliding fee scale based on income. These fee reductions have been enormously helpful to the uninsured, but the federal government encouraged increases in patient copays during the 1980s, and these have served as an obstacle to care in many cases. Joining us to discuss the community health centers, the migrant health centers, and the National Health Service Corps is Fitzhugh Mullen. He has served as director of the National Health Service Corps and later as Assistant Surgeon General. Currently, in addition to serving as a contributing editor to Health Affairs and a faculty member of the George Washington University School of Public Health, he practices pediatrics at the Upper Cardozo Community Health Center in Washington, D.C. Fitzhugh Mullen, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Oh, glad to be here, Marvin.
Why don't we start off by talking about what the health community health centers and the migrant health centers are, what types of services they offer and where they're located, that kind of thing.
Well, the community health center movement really goes back to the war on poverty in the mid-60s. Under the Kennedy and then Johnson administrations, there was a major effort to build a series of public programs, primarily at the federal level, to provide services for poor people that hadn't been provided before. To that point in time, the health and public health services that had been provided by the federal government were quite limited. The Public Health Service provided grants to state governments to provide public health clinics, which in the public health parlance are what we call categorical clinics. That means on Tuesday mornings you do well baby, and on Wednesday afternoons you do sexually transmitted diseases, and on Thursdays you do maternal and child health, or perhaps you have a clinic for pregnant women. But they're categories. They're not primary care. They're not cross-cutting. They're not a place you go to get your general medical care. One of the big needs of poor people was to have a place they could go to get general medical care. And the conception of the health centers was that that's what would be provided by, at the outset, fully funded, fully staffed, federally supported centers. And the first famous two were, and one was in a community, Columbia Point, just outside of Boston, and the other was in the Delta of Mississippi, Mound Bayou. And they were classic, much written about, much celebrated health centers where federal dollars paid for medical staff, nursing staff, outreach staff, social service staff, transportation, translation, janitorial services, the whole works. And from those centers, a number were developed, and over the years, the nature of the program changed. The war on poverty ended. The Nixon administration came along and was really interested in closing down or at least limiting this federal commitment to provide primary care. We're talking principally ambulatory care because these are outpatient facilities, but they didn't like them. It wasn't their notion of how care ought to be provided. And there were efforts to cut back, but unsuccessful. They had become quite well established in many communities with both patients and voters and politicians sticking up for them. But what happened over the years was that the full-service health center, where the federal government provided the full budget, gradually got whittled back. And over the years, the percent of the budget of what we today call a community health center has dropped to about a third of the budget is provided by the federal grant. And the other two-thirds, in general, the health center has to make up or get from Medicaid, Medicare, local grants, other kinds of state or city funding, indigent funds, charity care or charity funds, fundraisers, whatever.
And would I be correct in saying that the health centers, just as we saw in our last program talking, where we looked at the free clinics, that the health centers, also the community health centers, also have to spend a significant amount of time working on fundraising?
Certainly making their budget whole is a major, making their budget complete is a major challenge for any health center executive director. They do, most, in my experience, don't do fundraising in the sense of having charity balls or rummage sales or whatever, but they have to worry about getting Ryan White monies for HIV patients. They need to worry about getting a WIC clinic to cover the needs of pregnant mothers, et cetera, et cetera. So budgetary concerns are front and center for health center administrators. But the other thing that's happened over the years, the original concept of a full-service center that would provide medical services, yes, but psychosocial services and transportation and some education, that's been whittled back. And the models today are fairly medical in the sense they focus around the provision of medical care, which in fairness is why most patients come to a health center. But the more ambitious, full-service, community-oriented psychosocial center has been cut back to more of a medical model. The core of where money can be made in our system today is in provision of physical medical services. So the mental health and social service and transportation and outreach and translation, those don't generate funds. So the health center director has to scratch his head or her head hard to figure out how to provide those. At the health center that I work in, D.C., we have minimal mental health services and modest social services. We have a population with a lot of needs in those two areas. And as a clinician whose principal skills are in the clinical medical side of things, I'm reaching all the time for my colleagues in social services or mental health, and we're not very well staffed in those regards. It's hard.
Now, who is eligible to use the community health centers?
Eligibility is open to anyone. The principal folks who come are people with out insurance, and in many neighborhoods, people who have Medicaid, or to some extent, Medicare. I think it varies from place to place as to whether health centers take patients who have commercial insurance. In most of the neighborhoods where health centers are placed, there are not a lot of patients who do have commercial standard insurance, but it happens not infrequently. Where I work, sometimes I have patients who, because a husband or a wife, I'm a pediatrician, so I'm seeing the kids, but one of the parents gets a job which has insurance, and they get insurance. In our case, we don't take insurance. We aren't set up as a provider for many of the, certainly the HMOs in the neighborhood or in the city, so that essentially when a patient gets insured, they need to go elsewhere, which I always find from a continuity point of view disturbing. But it does mean that that patient's gotten into the mainstream of care, and health centers are, for better or for worse, safety net institutions designed to take care of those who really can't get into the mainstream very easily.
You mentioned that the first two community health centers that were established, one was in a poor urban community and the other was in a poor rural community. Would those two locations typify most of the health centers across the country currently?
I would think so. There are a number of criteria that need to be fulfilled in order to qualify, even to make an application to become a community health center. The principal one is that you have to be in what's called a medically underserved area. And a medically underserved area is a definition that is a combination of a number of things, including the poverty level, the infant mortality rate, the physician-to-population ratio in the neighborhood or in the area. And this works out as an index to an index of medically underserved, medical underservice, and the particular geographic area, the census tracts or the county or the area that you're applying from needs to qualify, and in competition needs to show figures that are, they tend to award health centers to those areas that have the worst figures, that is, that are the most underserved, and that defines where health centers are. So yes, I think health centers today continue to be in poor urban and rural areas.
Now, when a patient uses a community health center, is there anything about the process of going to a community health center that would distinguish it from, how would it feel different to a person who's going to a health, community health center versus a doctor's office?
Well, I think that depends a lot on the health center and on the doctor's office. As you can imagine, there are all kinds of community health centers in the United States, ranging from ones that are because of local support or fortunate grantsmanship, have constructed marvelous facilities that are every bit as have the amenities and the appearance of private offices. Others are work in sort of like hermit crabs in old institutions and schools, in abandoned parts of hospitals, in trailers. And obviously from the point of view of the appearance of the delivery site, it isn't what you'd see on the evening news when you're seeing a story about a medical breakthrough. It's not what you see on ER or Scrubs. I mean, these are very rudimentary facilities, some of them, which isn't to say that the care they receive isn't excellent or that's rendered there isn't excellent, but it, in some cases, in many cases, it would not, in either the eyes of the patient or the clinician, look like what we have come to think of as a private office, in which the amenities are pretty good.
And how does it work for the Migrant Health Center program? And tell us about that program and what its goals are.
Well, the Migrant Health Center program has been established to deal with a population that has a unique set of needs because they're migrant workers, and they are in a community so and so many months during the harvest, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, and then they go downstream or upstream, depending, back to where they live the rest of the year or on to other agricultural settings in other parts of the country. And the problems, of course, providing continuity, both for the patients as well as for medications and follow-up, are quite prodigious. But the migrant health centers are established in areas of high migrant activity in an effort to provide the care as well as can be provided with the knowledge of people going to be moving on, providing them with what they can in the way of portable information to take with them and links up and downstream as possible. I think it's important to say that here is a sector of the economy, the agricultural economy, that relies heavily on migrant labor, but does not provide any health benefits. And it's an example of one of the major parts of our economy that we get cheaper fruits and vegetables than we might because there are not health benefits for the workers. So we as a society benefit from the cheap produce, but we have a component of our society that's working without regular health coverage and a government program that kind of runs along behind and tries to provide some level of care absent the insurance that if people had insurance, it was portable, they could be seen regularly along the way, even if they were migrating.
What do you see as the greatest successes and also the greatest limitations of the services that community health centers provide?
They are a place where people can get services, even if they are without insurance and without money. The problems are that they're not everywhere in the country, and they are crowded in many places where they are. There's waiting lists, and they're busy. And finally, there's a set of problems that we ought to talk about as a practitioner that I've experienced a lot for patients who are uninsured as compared to those who have Medicaid. And that basically is that if you, there are, within the health center itself, there's a lot that you can do for people, depending upon the size and the staffing and the outfitting of the health center. Certainly bigger centers have a full range of primary care services, often with dentistry, sometimes with podiatry, occasionally with lab or x-ray on site, sometimes without lab or x-ray. But when you need to send a patient for a consultation to a cardiologist or a neurosurgeon, when you need to send someone to get an MRI or a CAT scan, or often just a chest film, when you need to send someone to get a complicated set of laboratory work, essentially the health center doesn't have that available, and you have to turn to the health system in general around, the local hospital, specialist in the area. Now, if the patient has Medicaid, the insurance carries on and they can get covered for specialist visits, laboratory tests, x-rays. If the patient doesn't have Medicaid, then you run into what I've written about and called the tin cup syndrome, where you as a doctor sort of banging your tin cup saying, you know, will you help me, will you help me, or will you help the patient, will you help the patient? And that makes for very irregular care. Sometimes, yes, you get people who make their services available, and sometimes the answer is no. It's almost impossible to get a consultant, or you can't get the patient seen at the hospital, or you can't get an x-ray. You can't get medications. Big problem. If a patient has Medicaid, they can go to the local pharmacy and pick up the antibiotic, pick up the diabetic medication, pick up the whatever it might be. They don't have insurance. You can give them the prescription, but going to the pharmacy isn't going to produce results unless they can pay for it. Now, there are a variety of kinds of programs that help out people, but they're complicated, irregular, and I've characterized the tin cup syndrome as kind of, you come to the end of the safety net, and then there's nothing there. And that's when you bang the tin cup in the hope something materializes. But it's bad medicine. It's not what we ought to be doing in America.
So community health center patients can easily end up with large bills from specialists and from hospitals for hospitalization or from lab testing and x-ray testing. That's your point you're making.
Absolutely. They can. They can also not get the test if the facility or the clinician turns them down. So yes, they can either not be treated at all or not get the test at all, or they can be treated, get the test, and end up with big bills, not discounted in any fashion.
Building a health center in a community or opening a migrant health program is obviously an important step, but I'd like you to talk a bit about the challenges communities have had recruiting doctors, dentists, and other professionals to work at these facilities. And in this context, it might make sense to tell listeners about the National Health Service Corps.
Staffing health centers has always been a challenge. They have, over the years, run in close association with another federal program called the National Health Service Corps, a program which trades scholarship or loan repayment support for a commitment to work in underserved areas, so that a medical student in medical school can apply for, and depending upon what's available in a given year, if he or she is lucky, get a scholarship for the National Service Corps. And that means that their tuition and expenses in medical school will be paid, but they incur a year-for-year obligation, 2 years of support, 2 years of obligation, 3 years of support, 3 years of obligation, et cetera, to work in underserved communities. And typically, every year, 500 to 1,000 young physicians become available through that mechanism, many of whom go to work in community health centers. They need to work in underserved areas as well to fulfill our obligation. So the health center program has benefited greatly from young physicians in the National Health Service Corps, nurses, dentists, mental health workers as well, physician's assistants sometimes, and nurse practitioners. All those types of clinicians are supported to some extent by the National Service Corps. They also have a loan repayment program in which individuals who do not have a scholarship obligation but who have very often incurred large indebtedness while going through medical school, if they agree to go to work in an underserved area, such as in a community health center, the government will pay down or help them pay down their loans pretty promptly in return for the service in the underserved area.
Now, let's return just a bit to the history that you began in terms of the origins of the health centers. And I'd like to take it into the decade of the 1980s. And I guess this comes to mind because at the very beginning of the presidential term of Ronald Reagan, the National Health Service Corps was defunded, if I'm not mistaken. So why don't you just update the rest of that history for the more recent 25 years?
Well, what happened was the National Service Corps was enacted in 1970. It was reluctantly signed by President Nixon. He didn't veto it. There was enough support for it. And it got started in the early 1970s in a very small way, a few hundred physicians placed around the country. So it's a pretty small program, even though it's a very important program for poor communities. But we have not put major muscle into this, as I think we could, and certainly there are many people in medical school and physicians and nurses and dentists who would happily serve and serve well if there were better support for the program. But when that got going, the idea was born after the program that a scholarship mechanism would be a way to attract people into the program. Originally, the idea was it'd just be government jobs or the government would support the salary of physicians. But it was clear you weren't going to get a lot of physicians to go into very poor areas for government salaries, which weren't very good. So the scholarship idea came along and was enacted in 1972. By the late 70s, large numbers of scholarship graduates were becoming available for service. You have to realize there's a lag time because the student gets the scholarship while in medical school, has to complete medical school. It might be 2 or 3 years, 4 years perhaps, depending upon how many years of support. Then they're excused, they're encouraged to take a residency in a primary care specialty. That would be medicine, family medicine, or pediatrics, or obstetrics and gynecology. That's 3 or 4 years. Then they become available for service. So by the late 70s, you had large numbers of scholarship recipients becoming available, and the National Service Corps, which I actually ran from the period of 1976 to 1981, went from about 500 physicians in the field to about 2,500, a huge growth, largely because of the maturation of the scholarship program. And then there was a Reagan election in 1980, came to office in 1981, and the president and his folks didn't like the idea of government docs. But they had a pipeline that was full of them because the scholarships were being awarded, had been awarded. So what they did essentially was they turned off the spigot on any new money for scholarships. They let the people in the pipeline come on through, and they allowed them to go to work on into the mid-1980s. And it took 4 or 5 years for that to wash through. And then all of a sudden, about 1986, 1987, there were no more scholarship graduates. And communities that had become used to having National Service Corps people available to them, health centers and small rural communities, all of a sudden, there was nobody there to replace Dr. Smith when he left or Dr. Jones when she left. And the political commotion that came about, and this was not hard to predict, but it did catch a lot of people, including members of Congress, who had happily let this situation develop. It caught them by surprise. And in the late 1980s, the first President Bush took credit for what he called reinventing the National Service Corps. Reinventing meant simply putting more money back into the scholarship program so more people went into the pipeline and came out the other end. Not a terribly complicated system, but one that did require a little political will. And from that time until the present, the program has been maintained at a level of about 2,000 to 3,000 clinicians in the field at any given time. In the last couple of years, the funding has gone up, and they're now talking about as many as 4,000 physicians in the field, and that represents a move in the right direction as far as I'm concerned, because there's huge need out there and there's a great deal of goodwill and interest on the part of clinicians who would like to serve, but they need the support.
And is 4,000 physicians a year enough to supply all the health centers across the country?
It isn't. I think the health center staffing is probably 2 or 3 times that the size of that, and all National Service Corps people don't work in health centers per se, in community health centers per se. Some work elsewhere, but it's a step in the right direction. Health centers hire docs off the street who don't have scholarship obligations or don't have loan repayment, and there are large numbers of clinicians who are prepared to work in underserved areas because they think it's a important work, it's a rewarding work, it's a real calling for some people. The problems are probably greater in rural areas because clinicians in urban areas can work in a tough inner city area and live in a relatively more comfortable area and commute easily enough. In a rural area, you don't have commuting as a possibility. You live and work in the rural area. and particularly poor rural areas and particularly isolated rural areas, it's often hard to get physicians to come and to stay. So the National Service Corps and various programs like that that have individuals with a payback obligation for scholarships and loan repayments is an important aspect or important element of a larger strategy to provide health equity across our communities.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm Marvin Malik. My guest has been Fitzhugh Mullen. We've been discussing the healthcare safety net. We started out the discussion by looking at the community health centers and the National Health Service Corps. After the break, Gordon Schiff will be joining us to talk about the role of the public hospitals in the healthcare safety net. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's show is the second of a two-part series exploring our nation's healthcare safety net, the institutions and programs that attempt to provide care to the 44 million uninsured individuals in the United States. Uninsured individuals are less likely to have a regular medical provider and are also much more likely to delay or forego what they believe to be necessary medical care. On today's show, Fitzhugh Mullen has joined us to discuss the community health centers and the National Health Service Corps, both key safety net programs. And last month, we took an in-depth look at the free clinics. The final key component of the healthcare safety net, especially in major cities across the country, are the public hospitals. While over 1,000 hospitals across the country are supported by state and local funding, 100 of these hospitals comprise a key core component of the safety net. Only a minute fraction of the patients who use these hospitals have private insurance coverage. These hospitals are largely located in medium and large cities. Most are closely affiliated with academic medical centers and provide key sites for the training of nurses and medical students. Though they comprise only 2% of the country's 5,000 hospitals, these safety net public hospitals provide just over a quarter of the care to uninsured individuals who cannot pay their hospital bills. These hospitals provide care to all who need it and typically run very busy emergency departments and trauma centers. Many communities rely on public hospitals for most of the care provided to accident and trauma victims. In addition, virtually all of these hospitals have large ambulatory care clinics. While at the average community health center there are 6 physicians, the average public hospital clinic is 10 times larger. All told, the 100 safety net public hospitals serve about the same number of patients as the 3,000 migrant and community health center, about 10 million people. And in each case, about 4 million of these individuals have no form of health insurance coverage. Gordon Schiff is joining us today to discuss the work he does at Cook County Hospital, and also to talk about the ability of the public hospitals across the country to serve as an effective safety net. Dr. Schiff serves on the faculty of the University of Illinois' College of Medicine and is author of many research articles and policy reviews concerning the healthcare safety net in the United States. He has spent 25 years providing care to the large number of uninsured patients of Chicago at Cook County Hospital. And for over a decade, he served as director of the General Medicine Clinic, the hospital's main clinic that provides primary care services to adults. Listeners familiar with my own career know that I did my residency training at Cook County Hospital as well. Gordon Schiff, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Greetings.
In a large number of major cities across the country, clinics run by public hospitals are a key provider of primary care services to those who don't have health insurance. How do you feel the clinics at Cook County Hospital are doing in meeting the need for primary care in the city of Chicago?
When I was director of the General Medicine Clinic at Cook County Hospital, which is a large primary care clinic, in about a 14-month period, we had over 20,000 patients on the waiting list as they accumulated, referred from our emergency room. I did my best. I used to go there every night and try and squeeze in a patient or two extra on people's cards for the residents and the attending doctors to see.
During the interviews I recorded with representatives from and patients from the free clinics, we found out that free clinic patients often have to travel quite a long distance, often passing by doctors, even be practicing quite close to their home, in order to get to a free clinic because they can't afford to get care at all those other doctors' offices. And I was wondering if patients if there's only one or a few public hospitals in a large city, such as, say, yours, Chicago, is that often the case in Chicago that patients might have to travel a fairly long distance and that may be a problem for them to receive care?
At Cook County Hospital, patients are definitely coming from very wide distances throughout the county. The hope is that they could get care in our community clinics, which are nearer to their homes, and then when they need more tertiary specialized care, then they would be referred to the main hub, to the main hospital. But unfortunately, the supply of community clinics, the resources to take care of the patient's problems in the community from the public sector is insufficient, so a lot of patients end up coming directly to our hospital. Another thing that drives people to our hospital, frankly, is that a lot of the community clinics, whether they're city clinics or even county clinics or other providers in the community, the out-of-pocket expenses are sufficiently steep for the patients. It wouldn't sound like a lot of money to us, $5 or $10 maybe, but for these patients, this is prohibitively expensive. So, sure, patients are bypassing nearby clinics and hospitals all the time to come to Cook County.
Now, you mentioned the issue of what kinds of fees clinics charge. And at many community health centers, the fees are high enough so that it does discourage care. And, of course, the opposite is true at the free clinics, where patients only donate and don't have to donate more than they feel able to. How does the issue of billing and paying for care work at the public hospitals, or at least at Cook County Hospital where you work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of a hard generalization and a moving target. I think historically hospitals like Cook County have essentially been free. The services have been not based on billing and certainly billing patients directly. I think the generalization that I could make, at least in terms of our hospital, is we make every effort to be able to collect third-party funds, reimbursements for patients who come. So that means patients who are on Medicaid or Medicare or who have private insurance, which, believe it or not, there still is a few percent of patients who do. Those patients, we definitely aggressively try to collect the reimbursement that we're entitled to. For the other patients, I would say that it's sort of a series of pendulum swings. We have a group of administrators come in and say, oh boy, a rich person could come to Cook County and get care for free, and this is ripping off the public sector, and we can't stand this, and we have to discourage frivolous visits, so we have to start charging people and being more aggressive, sending things to collection agencies. And of course, once that hot air and rhetoric gets down to the reality of the fact that it costs more to collect, costs, you know, $5 to collect 50 cents from these patients, so it's, there's no money to be gained, and discouraging people putting a copay that's not going to be prohibitively high that actually raises any money is kind of an impossible formula to strike that balance. So the whole ideology of users' fees and forcing people to pay and billing the patients, in effect punishing people who are sick, it doesn't really have go very far as far as funding public hospitals. So I think my prejudice, and I'm speaking from very strongly held convictions, watching this pendulum swing back and forth over the years where these measures are implemented and then there's an outcry. Patients come forward with horrible stories that appear in the newspaper, and they back away from turning over the bills to collection agencies. So in theory, there is a sliding scale, and we call it an ability-to-pay plan that's adjusted on patients' income. But in reality, as the patients tell us, it's, you can't squeeze blood from a stone.
Since you joined us after the break, you weren't able to hear Fitzhugh Mullen's description of what needs to happen when patients at community health centers need expensive tests or a referral to a specialist. He described what he calls the tin cup syndrome, in which doctors are put in a position where they have to beg hospitals or specialists in the community to substantially reduce their fees for uninsured patients he's trying to refer to that specialist. And last month we learned that much the same process occurs at free clinics. Now, this contrasts with the public hospitals. During my residency training at Cook County Hospital, every specialty area was represented, and that really made a difference in the quality of care we provided. And that really contrasts with the work I've done since then at community health centers and free clinics. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, we have an organized system of care, or we strive to. The problem has to do with supply and demand. The problem is that we can't provide that one in one hospital for the whole city. But the point you're making is that are we ready to go if somebody needs endoscopy because they develop a GI bleed, that we don't have to get the tin cup, as you said, and go out begging somebody to see the patient. We have those facilities there. And I think the way you started the program, we've just decided as a society we're going to put these things in place, and we're going to be prospectively recognizing that there's a need for these services and funding them. And that's really what the public hospital represents. It's not something foreign or alien from the patients. It's really, it's what the community has invested as its capital to have those services available when they're needed.
So at a large...
So it's not an ad hoc thing. I mean, we're really saying we know that in a population base of 100,000 people that you're going to need to do 400 endoscopies a year. I mean, this is basic epidemiology, and community-oriented care can tell us that and predict that.
Since you have a waiting list to get into the medicine clinic that takes, I guess, as much as a year and a half if the emergency department is trying to refer a patient for a medicine clinic, does a patient who's already in medicine clinic then face the same obstacle to specialty clinics? Are they just as crowded and difficult to get into, or once a patient has pierced through and made it into the medicine clinic at county hospital, can they then get specialty care referrals when they require them?
I think once patients are in the system, we like to think that our obligation to care for those patients is probably a notch greater than just anybody at large, and we do take that seriously, and those patients get a priority.
Thinking about the many thousands of uninsured patients you've treated over the years at Cook County Hospital, do you view Cook County and other public hospitals as a potential solution to the problems that uninsured patients face in the United States?
Well, I think like the other safety net pillars that we're trying to stand on, be it free clinics, community clinics, and safety net providers such as public hospitals that are specifically funded to take care of the uninsured and the underserved, this is only able to meet a fraction of the need. Let me just tell you, they've just built a new Cook County Hospital. This is something the community has struggled with for perhaps 3 or 4 decades that I've been actually part of the struggle for much of that. We just opened up a new hospital that is way too small. We have less than 500 beds, and probably we need twice that many. So I've just taken care of patients today on my ward. Somebody got admitted finally to a bed on Thursday. He arrived in the emergency room on Monday. This is a guy with advanced heart failure. We're seeing more and more patients who are not your traditional minority, lower socioeconomic stereotype patients, but these are people who have been employed, and obviously county is there to serve everybody, but this is a completely imbalance of supply and demand. We have gridlock in our emergency room. Our clinics are overbooked. It takes a year and a half to get a mammogram, and if you're lucky at that, people are being sent home even if they've waited a year and a half, because then there's not enough space because the emergencies are bumping them off. So I guess what I'm seeing is a tremendous imbalance of supply and demand. We're there in the public hospital. You could say we're a solution by providing access to everybody, but there's no way we're able to keep up with the demand for our services.
And you feel that probably would represent other public hospitals across the country?
Yeah, that's a very easy generalization to make and safely document.
Turning our attention back to the community health centers for a moment, previous Republican presidents have generally cut funding or at best level funded the community health centers. On the other hand, the current Bush administration has proposed a significant increase in funding. Dr. Schiff, you recently published an article in the Journal of Public Health Policy which analyzed the likely impact of the Bush Health Center initiative. Tell us about your findings.
Just like the AMA is putting an emphasis on volunteerism and free clinics as an answer to the healthcare crisis, so are the So is the Bush administration saying that by some additional funding to community health centers, we can use that as a substitute or as a band-aid for the problems that we've been describing. The increase, which has actually been lauded and touted as such a great amount, is actually about 13% a year over the next 5 years. What this means is it'll be a total of $1.5 billion given to community health centers this year. And again, even with this increase, we're talking barely $40 per uninsured person. So if you consider the fact that it costs, on the average, the per capita cost is $5,600 per capita. That's what a health insurance plan would cost. That's what we're spending on the average in this country. You can imagine that $40 doesn't go very far to cover that. And in fact, these are patients who are quite sick. They're people who live in poverty communities who have lots of chronic illnesses, asthma, diabetes, hypertension, disproportionately to the general population. So that puts the $40 even a greater perspective of how it falls short. The problems that we're trying to spotlight is the ways that, just as we've heard for free clinics, the ways that the solutions are completely falling short of what the needs are.
Fitzhugh Mullen, I'd also like to hear your thoughts on the Bush Community Health Center initiative.
Well, I think the point is a good one. But first of all, I'll say that much to the surprise of many people, President Bush has taken a stand in favor of community health centers and has proposed increased budgets for community health centers in each year of his administration. And those have come to pass in the ultimate budget. That is a positive step, and it's a good direction. Now, there are, and the reasons are alleged to be because, as governor of Texas, he had reason to look straight in the face the problems of poor people and underservice, and understood that health centers are a fairly direct way of delivering a benefit to these folks in a fairly efficient fashion. So he thinks it's a good program. He's been supportive. Now, where does that rate out, however, in the larger scale of things. I think Gordon Schiff's putting this in perspective is important because the amount of dollars actually being invested are pretty small, and given the magnitude of the problem, they're not going to turn things around. There are people more cynical or perhaps more sober yet who say that the funding of health centers is a health policy excuse for taking on the much tougher and more expensive job of designing and implementing a full system of coverage for everybody.
I'd like to pick up on that issue more. I, in preparing for this interview, I visited the website of the National Association of Community Health Centers. And they presented data indicating that in the last calendar year, across the country, the community health centers provided care to 3.9 million uninsured individuals. So I calculated out that number compared to the total number of uninsured people in the country, which was last year was 43.6 million. And that came out to 8%. So I guess I'd like to ask you, with or without the Bush administration funding increase, whether the community health centers as we know them are in a strong position to really take a larger role in providing medical care to the other 92% of the population of the U.S. who lack health insurance.
Well, I think that's entirely a question of how much more money gets put into the health center program. But beyond that, there's a question of strategy. I think that health centers are a very, very important element of the safety net. That is providing something to break the free fall of people who don't have coverage and to cushion the fall of those who have partial coverage of various sorts. But the most important thing that we could do for all Americans is to provide a package of health insurance that would give the individual the right to go to any system and have their care paid for. Free clinics and health centers and other kinds of safety net institutions are problemed by a variety of insufficiencies. They're terrific for what they do, and I work in them, and I support them, and I want my tax dollars to go for them, but they're not the whole answer. The whole answer for health equity in America is universal coverage, universal health insurance, and that's what we've got to work towards.
On the many hours of conversations and recordings I made preparing for last month's show on the free clinics here in Vermont, every single staff member and patient who had an opinion on what they wanted to see happen in the U.S. said some version of the same thing. They don't like a system in which people are on and off insurance depending on their job, or on and off Medicaid or Medicare, or subject to very high costs if they're part of a small business. Instead, they all want a system of national health care in which everyone is included regardless of income, age, or one's job situation. And now we've heard Dr. Mullen say much the same thing. So, Dr. Schiff, let me give you the last word on the issue for today's show.
It's the only way to go. Otherwise, you just have all these what's called the death spirals, where you try to spin off the healthy patients, remove them from the pool, leaving behind the sicker patients for the public sector to take care of. So this is, just from a sort of a logical way to organize this, you have to share the cost. And by the way, it's congruent with notions of us Americans being together rather than against each other. It's not that young people shouldn't pay for old people and rich people. I mean, a young person is just an old person, 40 years ahead of being sick and older. So I think we're this idea where everybody contributes and everybody benefits. We don't spend all these resources for everybody trying to pass the buck and exclude this group and deny care to that group. It's an efficient way. It's a fair way. It's a logical way. It's the only way that really is congruent with the values of the American people.
Well, Gordon Schiff and Fitzhugh Mullen, I'd like to thank you both for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thank you, Marvin. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks, Marvin.
Well, that's it for today's show. For listeners interested in learning more about the healthcare safety net, A fine report on the topic was prepared in the year 2000 by the Institute of Medicine. Their website is iom.edu. For listeners who'd like to review the proposal for a universal healthcare system, released last August by Marcia Angel and supported by over 10,000 other physicians, that website is physiciansproposal.org. Additional links on today's topics are available at the Public Health Radio website, publichealthradio.org. Also at the website, web browsers can tune in to most of the previous shows we've aired, including last month's documentary on the free clinics and the state of the safety net in Vermont. Public Health Radio is looking for volunteers, especially to work on the website and to work on grant writing. Let us know if you'd like to volunteer. And we're also seeking your feedback on the show. Tell us what you like and what you don't like. We're always looking for new ideas. Once again, the website is publichealthradio.org. Thanks for tuning in, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.